I want you to picture a scenario for a minute and really try to visualize the details of this. Imagine a world where human civilization produces, well, more than enough to give every single person on the planet a profoundly decent life.
Right, like an absolute staggering level of abundance.
Exactly. I mean, there is enough food harvested right now to comfortably feed everyone, you know? There are enough raw materials extracted to build sturdy, comfortable housing for everyone on Earth.
Yeah, the raw capacity is definitely there. We have the energy generation to keep every home warm in the winter, cool in the summer, and completely connected to the internet.
We do. We have the technology, we have the labor force, we have the logistical networks. But in this exact same scenario, the machinery used to produce all of this abundance is simultaneously like devouring the planet's ecosystem.
Right, it's pumping out emissions that push the climate way past its breaking point.
Ripping up ancient forests, polluting vital waterways. And somehow, despite all of this massive production, it's leaving billions of people trapped in severe, grinding poverty.
It's just wild to think about.
It is a world of incredible, almost unimaginable productive capacity, operating right alongside catastrophic human deprivation and ecological collapse. And well, you don't have to imagine very hard, do you? Because according to the dense but absolutely fascinating academic white paper we are exploring today, that is the exact reality of the global economy we live in right now.
It really is the defining paradox of our time. You know, the source material we are looking at today calls this the double crisis.
The double crisis,
Yeah,
right?
so we have severe ecological overshoot happening above us in the atmosphere and the biosphere. And then at the exact same time, devastating human deprivation persisting below us in our communities. We are literally breaking the planet to produce more than enough, yet somehow failing to meet the basic needs of the majority of humanity.
Okay, let's unpack this. Today, our mission on this deep dive is to synthesize a major white paper published in May 2026 by Dr. Bechara Sajali. It's titled, let me get this right, An Economy Answerable to Life, Beyond GDP, Unequal Exchange, and the Life-Coherent Reordering of Progress.
It's quite a mouthful.
It really is. Now, right off the bat, I want to be incredibly clear with you, the listener. This paper dives deep into some, well, heavily contested, politically charged economic critiques.
Oh, absolutely. It takes a very hard look at the structural flaws of global capitalism.
Yes, and the dynamics of structural imperialism and the massive inequalities built into global trade. So our goal here today is not to take a political side, not to champion a specific ideology, and definitely not to tell you what to believe about capitalism, socialism, or any other economic system.
Right, we're just mapping it out.
Exactly. We are here strictly to impartially map out Dr. Sajali's arguments. We want to break down the models and data presented in this text and help you understand the profound systemic insights hidden within this highly academic framework. We're essentially your guides to the material, trying to figure out what this author is proposing about the way our world operates.
If we connect this to the bigger picture, what this deep dive is really about is a fundamental shift in how we measure success as a species.
I love that framing.
Right. Because for nearly a century, our ultimate economic compass has been calibrated to measure money, specifically through gross domestic product or GDP.
Famous GDP.
Yeah. And Dr. Sajali's paper, which synthesizes the work of numerous economists and system theorists, argues that we need to completely shift that compass. We need to stop measuring the mere accumulation of money and start measuring the generation and protection of life.
So the argument is that our current compass is not just, you know, slightly off. It's actively directing us toward our own destruction.
Precisely.
Let's start right there with this idea of a broken compass, because the paper kicks off by referencing a major 2026 United Nations report called Counting What Counts, A Compass of Progress for People and Planet.
Yeah, that was a huge report.
It was. And in this report, the UN proposes a globally applicable dashboard of 31 distinct indicators designed to complement GDP. They're looking at well-being outcomes, equity, environmental sustainability, all that stuff.
And the reason the UN is pushing for this is because they recognize a fundamental, glaring blind spot in GDP.
Right. GDP is entirely blind to whether an economic activity is, like, life-generating or life-damaging.
Exactly. That blind spot is actually a structural feature of the metric itself. I mean, GDP is simply a measure of monetized economic activity within a given time period. It does not possess a moral, ethical, or even ecological
That's
filter.
just a raw number.
Right. The paper points out something that seems absurd when you say it out loud. Massive pollution cleanup rampant illness that requires extensive medical spending, deforestation, military expansion.
Wait, disaster recovery too, right?
Oh, absolutely. Speculative construction bubbles and disaster recovery can all cause GDP to skyrocket. Think about a massive oil spill off a beautiful coastline.
Okay, picturing it.
The local ecosystem is devastated, wildlife is dying, fishing communities completely lose their livelihoods. But the billions of dollars spent hiring cleanup crews, deploying chemical dispersants, engaging in years of corporate litigation, all of that actually registers as a massive boost to the national GDP.
Wow. So the metric is just structurally indifferent to the difference between something that nourishes life, like growing healthy food, and something that destroys it, like cleaning up an entirely preventable toxic disaster.
It literally cannot tell the difference. Money is moving, so the number goes up. The Beyond GDP movement, which the UN report champions, is a crucial recognition that this single metric cannot adequately measure social resilience or the future viability of a society.
You know, I often think of GDP like a car's speedometer. It tells you that you are going 100 miles an hour down the highway. It gives you a highly accurate number regarding your velocity.
Right.
But it doesn't tell you if you're driving toward a hospital to save someone's life or if you're driving straight off a cliff. It just says, hey, we're going fast. Number go up.
That is a perfect analogy.
And for a long time, we've just cheered for the speed. But wait, if we, and by we, I mean the global community, the UN, the leading economists. If we know the compass is broken, why do we keep using it? Why is it still the headline number every time a politician gives a speech?
That is the exact pivotal question Dr. Sahali raises early in the text. The paper argues that the UN's Beyond GDP movement, while incredibly important for awareness, simply isn't enough to change our trajectory.
Why not? A 31-indicator dashboard sounds pretty comprehensive.
It is, but it's like putting a new dashboard on the bridge of a ship. Mismeasurement is just a symptom of the crisis. The actual disease is misorganization.
Misorganization, therefore.
Yeah. We are powering our global vessel with an engine that was fundamentally designed for accumulation, not for human well-being. To explain why we cling to GDP, the text introduces the work of philosopher John McMurtry, specifically his concept of life value, onto axiology.
Onto axiology.
Yeah.
Wow. Okay, that is a seriously heavy academic phrase. Let's break that down for the listener so it doesn't just sound like textbook jargon.
It sounds super intimidating, I know. But the underlying concept is actually very intuitive. Axiology is the philosophical study of value. Like,
right.
What is good? What is bad? How do we judge the worth of something? McMurtry argues that our current global economic system operates on a strict money value logic. In a money value system, the ultimate unquestionable good is expanding monetized activity and accumulating more money.
So turning money into more money.
Exactly. The entire structure of the system, the laws, the trade agreements, the corporate mandates, is built for that sole purpose. In stark contrast, McMurtry proposes a life value logic.
Okay, and how does that differ?
In this alternate framework, value is strictly grounded in the enabling of life capacities. A life capacity is anything that allows a human being or an ecosystem to breathe, feel, think, and act in a healthy way.
Oh, I see.
So disvalue, then, is anything that causes the loss, reduction, or destruction of that life capacity.
Okay, let me make sure I'm wrapping my head around this.
Mm-hmm.
Under McMurtry's framework, GDP persists not because economists are just stubborn or lack imagination, but because GDP is actually the perfect measurement for what a capital-centered economy is designed to do.
Hit the nail on the head.
It measures the accumulation of money. It was never designed to measure human happiness or ecological balance in the first place.
That is exactly right. GDP isn't a mistake within the current system. It is the statistical shadow of a deeper civilizational inversion. It perfectly mirrors an economy where monetary throughput can expand massively while the actual capacities of life, human health, ecological stability, community resilience deteriorate.
So back to your ship analogy.
Right. The paper argues that you can put a new dashboard of 31 UN indicators on the bridge of the ship. Those indicators can flash red and diagnose that the vessel is heading straight toward a catastrophic iceberg.
But the indicators don't steer the ship.
Exactly. Indicators alone cannot automatically redirect the engine down in the engine room because the engine is functioning exactly as it was built to function, to burn fuel and go faster.
Man, that highlights the incredible tension between what we produce and what we actually need.
Mm.
The paper leans heavily on the political economy work of Jason Hickel here, specifically his 2026 lecture on capitalism, imperialism, and ecology to explore this tension.
Yes, Hickel's work is central here.
He looks deeply at that paradox we started with, right? The double crisis. If you visualize this, imagine a tight room where the ceiling is suddenly pressing down on you. That's ecological overshoot, breaching the planetary boundaries of carbon and biodiversity.
Right, we're hitting the ceiling.
And at the exact same time, the floor is giving way beneath your feet. That's human deprivation. Billions lacking basic necessities. We are basically being crushed in the middle.
Hickel's research brings a staggering data point to this visual of the crushing room. His needs-based analysis, which he co-authored with researcher Dylan Sullivan, looks at the actual material requirements to support human life.
Okay, what do they find?
They estimate that we could achieve decent living standards for all 8.5 billion people on Earth using approximately 30% of our current global resource and energy use.
Wait, 30%? Just a third?
Just 30%.
I really want that statistic to sink in for you, the listener. We could give every single person on the planet a decent life, meaning secure housing, adequate nutrition, healthcare, education, mobility, and connectivity, using less than a third of the resources we are currently tearing out of the ground and pumping into the atmosphere.
It's mind-blowing when you really think about it.
It totally upends the standard economic narrative we hear every day. Because the standard narrative is that poverty exists because we just don't have enough stuff yet. The story goes that the pie isn't big enough, so we have to keep growing the pie, keep extracting, keep expanding, and eventually the wealth will trickle down and lift everyone out of poverty.
But the text says, no, aggregate scarcity is a total myth. We have more than enough. The problem is the systematic misallocation of all that production.
It is a profound crisis of misaligned production. The aggregate productive capacity of our global civilization is absolutely sufficient to end poverty tomorrow, but that capacity is being diverted, and the paper details exactly where it is being diverted.
Right. It maps out how global production is split into two massive categories. On one hand, you have what the paper terms destructive excess.
Destructive excess.
Yeah. These are highly profitable, extremely resource-intensive, and ecologically harmful activities that are vastly overprovided by the market.
The text gets very specific here about what constitutes this destructive excess. It lists the mass production of SUVs, the endless cycle of fast fashion, the proliferation of private jets, the construction of luxury speculative housing that just sits empty.
Industrial-scale beef production, the massive global militarized production complex.
And our persistent, subsidized dependence on fossil fuels. We overproduce these things at a staggering, almost incomprehensible rate. And at the exact same time, the text points out that we severely underproduce life necessities.
Which are the things we actually need to survive.
Right. This category includes affordable public housing, localized nutritious food systems, comprehensive public transport, decentralized renewable energy, robust sanitation infrastructure, universal health care, and education. So my question to you is, if the productive capacity is clearly there, the factories are built, the labor force is ready, is it just human incompetence?
What do you mean?
Like, are we just really bad at organizing ourselves so we accidentally end up making billions of tons of fast fashion that ends up in a landfill instead of building affordable housing for our communities?
Hickel's analysis, which Saley synthesizes here, argues that it is emphatically not incompetence. We are highly competent at organizing global supply chains. The misalignment is the system working exactly as it was designed to work.
So it's intentional.
Well, it's structural. This dynamic is what Hickel calls the capitalist law of value. Under this specific organization of production, capital flows to where profit margins and the potential for rapid accumulation are the highest. It does not flow to where human need is the greatest.
Okay, that makes sense.
The core objective of production in this system is to maximize capital for shareholders, not to maintain ecological conditions or meet universal human needs. Think about the mechanics of it. Fast fashion yields rapid high-margin returns. You can design, produce, and sell a cheap garment in weeks, exploiting cheap labor and unregulated environmental laws, and realize a massive profit.
While affordable housing, by its very definition, limits profit margins to remain accessible to low-income people.
Exactly. Therefore, global capital heavily invests in fast fashion, private jets, and speculative real estate, while it chronically underfunds the vital necessities of life.
It's a feature, not a bug. The misalignment is baked into the very DNA of how investment works. It's doing exactly what we programmed it to do.
That is the harsh reality the paper presents. And to conceptualize a solution, the text introduces the concept of the safe and just space, referencing the famous donut economics model developed by Kate Raworth.
I've heard of the donut model. How does it fit in here?
The idea is that we need to establish a sufficiency corridor for humanity. The floor of this corridor is a minimum life capacity, you know, ensuring decent living standards for all, leaving no one falling into deprivation.
Okay, that's the floor.
And the ceiling of this corridor is the life-supporting capacity of the planet. The ecological boundaries, like atmospheric carbon and ocean acidification, that we cannot cross without triggering a systemic collapse. A life-coherent economy, according to the text, is one that operates entirely within that narrow corridor, ensuring there is enough for all while staying within the natural conditions that allow life to continue.
That paints a very clear mental picture. You have the floor of human deprivation, the ceiling of ecological overshoot, and we need to navigate the ship right through that middle corridor.
Yep.
But the paper argues that when we fail to navigate that corridor, when we crash through the ceiling or let people fall through the floor, the result isn't just an inefficient market. The result is actual, measurable violence. And here, the text brings in the work of Johan Galtung, a foundational peace and conflict researcher, and his theory of structural violence.
Galtung's framework is absolutely essential for understanding the moral weight of this economic critique. We usually think of violence in very narrow terms, right, as direct physical harm, like one person striking another or two nations going to war.
Sure, kinetic violence.
But Galtung introduced the concept of structural violence to describe situations where avoidable deprivation and the impairment of human life chances are built directly into social, economic, or political arrangements.
Let's look at the mechanics of this. Give me an example.
Well, if a society lacks the resources, the technology, or the knowledge to cure a disease or build shelter and people suffer, that is a tragedy. But if a system has ample resources, advanced medical technology, and surplus building materials, yet systematically denies healthcare or housing to a portion of the population simply because it isn't profitable to provide it to them, that is a form of violence.
Wow.
It shortens lives, it predictably constrains human potential, and it violently prevents the satisfaction of basic physiological needs.
It's like an algorithm running perfectly efficiently, doing exactly what its code dictates without a single error. But its core function is to systematically deny a specific group of people access to clean water or medicine.
Hmm.
We wouldn't look at that and call it a brilliant success of software engineering. We'd call it a humanitarian catastrophe.
Exactly.
But we do look at our economy that way. We celebrate the efficiency of the algorithm even when it starves people. And the text explains exactly why we do that, introducing Galtung's companion concept of cultural violence.
Cultural violence.
Yeah. Which occurs when we normalize this structural deprivation through specific narratives and language.
The narratives we tell ourselves are the glue that holds the structural violence in place. Cultural violence is what makes structural violence seem acceptable, natural, or even inevitable. The paper notes that we use highly sanitized terms like market inevitability, economic efficiency, modernization, or fiscal discipline to justify why millions of people must go without their basic needs.
It really hides the reality of it.
It does. When we frame a massive shortage of affordable housing as just the natural outcome of supply and demand curves, rather than recognizing it as a conscious systemic misallocation of resources toward luxury development and speculative assets, we are engaging in cultural violence. We use these economic theories to mask the structural harm being done to real human bodies and communities.
I want you, the listener, to really think about your own community for a second. Think about walking down the street in a major metropolitan city. When you see unhoused people sleeping in tents on the cold sidewalk right next to towering, gleaming luxury condominiums that are mostly empty because they're held as speculative assets by international holding companies.
It's a common sight.
It is.
Yeah.
And according to this text, you aren't just seeing an inefficient market or a policy failure. You are witnessing structural violence in action. You are seeing the capitalist law of value actively prioritizing money value over life value, resulting in avoidable human suffering. It completely changes how you look at a city skyline. Those empty glass towers aren't just buildings, they are monuments to a system that shows accumulation over human shelter.
It forces a profound cognitive shift. It moves the analysis of our society from cold economics to deep ethics and from objective measurement to a diagnosis of harm. The critique of GDP suddenly becomes a critique of the very institutions and power structures that determine how we use our collective resources.
We've been talking a lot about how things are misallocated within a domestic society, like a single city or a country. But wait, if we fix our domestic economy and suddenly provide affordable housing, universal health care, and green infrastructure for everyone in the global north, doesn't that just mean we need a massive influx of raw materials?
Oh, absolutely.
Where are those materials coming from? This takes us to a massive global expansion of these ideas. The focus of the paper shifts to the international stage, looking at Jason Hickel's theory of unequal exchange. The paper argues that a wealthy country's domestic dashboard might look incredibly green, sustainable, and prosperous, but it might be secretly externalizing all of its ecological and human costs onto other nations.
This is a critical addition to the Beyond GDP conversation because it prevents us from celebrating false victories. Hickel frames the world economy as being structured largely between a core, which generally encompasses the high-income nations of the global north, and a periphery, generally the lower-income nations of the global south.
Core and periphery.
Right. And his extensive research, including a landmark 2024 study published in Nature Communications, demonstrates that the immense accumulation of wealth and the high living standards in the core depend heavily on a massive, structural, and ongoing drain of resources from the periphery.
The text details the specific mechanisms of this unequal exchange.
Yeah.
And it's vital to understand how it actually works. It's a two-way flow of trade, but it is wildly systematically imbalanced. From the global south to the global north, you have a massive net flow of embodied labor, raw materials, energy, land usage, and ecological space.
Right, the real tangible wealth.
Exactly. The factory workers, the mine minerals, the agricultural output, the deforestation required to grow soy for cattle. It all flows north to sustain high consumption lifestyles and capital accumulation. But what flows south in return?
It's not equitable wealth, that's for sure.
No. The text lists crushing debt service payments, massive profit repatriation by multinational corporations, devastating climate damages, the offloading of pollution and waste burdens, and severe constraints on their ability to develop their own economies.
The benefits of global production are highly concentrated in the core, while the ecological and social costs are ruthlessly externalized to the periphery. And the mechanisms driving this aren't just isolated, unfair trade deals. They are deeply structural.
Like what? What's a structural mechanism?
Let's look at one of the primary mechanisms. Structural adjustment programs tied to international debt. A developing nation takes on debt from international financial institutions, often just to survive a crisis. To service that debt, they are mandated to implement structural adjustment programs.
And what do those programs actually do?
They force the nation to cut public spending on health and education, privatize their state-owned assets, and orient their entire economy toward exporting raw materials to the north to earn foreign currency. They literally convert land that was used for subsistence farming to feed their own people into massive plantations growing cash crops like coffee or sugar for export.
That is brutal.
The local population starves or is forced into exploitative wage labor, while the global north gets cheap coffee and debt repayment. The result is that the global south is structurally drained of the very productive capacity, land, and labor it desperately needs to secure decent living standards for its own people.
Here's where it gets really interesting. Let me pose a hypothetical to you based on this specific framework. Let's say a wealthy nation in the global north decides to get serious about climate change. They hit all of their green targets. They transition their entire domestic fleet to electric vehicles. They run their grid entirely on solar and wind power. And their domestic Beyond GDP dashboard is glowing a vibrant green. Everyone has high well-being. The local air is clean. The local rivers are pristine.
Sounds like a utopia.
But to achieve this utopian domestic transition, that nation imports millions of tons of lithium, cobalt, and copper that were mined in the global south. And those mines completely destroyed local ecosystems, permanently depleted indigenous water tables, and relied on violently exploited labor. How does Dr. Saley's life-coherent framework judge that supposedly green northern nation?
Oh, under this life-coherent framework, that northern nation is not progressing at all. It is actively engaging in what the paper defines as cross-border life drain.
Cross-border life drain.
Yes. The text introduces the specific concept to demand what it calls relational accountability. Cross-border life drain refers to the transfer of labor, land, materials, and ecological space from one society to another in ways that directly impair the life capacity of the society providing them.
So you can't just look at the domestic dashboard.
No, the domestic dashboard of the northern nation might look flawlessly green, but the life-coherent framework insists that no society can be considered genuinely progressing or sustainable if its well-being depends on the deprivation, exploitation, or ecological destabilization of another society. It completely shatters the illusion that national progress can be assessed in a vacuum.
It's basically saying you can't clean your own house by sweeping all your dirt, your toxic waste, and your labor abuses into your neighbor's living room, and then proudly claim to have the cleanest house on the block.
Exactly.
Relational accountability is such a powerful, piercing lens. It forces us to look at the entire supply chain of our prosperity. But addressing this massive global imbalance brings us to a concept, a single word, that frankly terrifies a lot of mainstream economists and politicians. The paper introduces the concept of degrowth, but it redefines it as differentiated convergence.
Yeah, the term degrowth is highly provocative and, as the text notes, frequently misunderstood or intentionally misrepresented in political discourse. When most people hear the word degrowth, they immediately imagine a mandated, painful reduction in their quality of life.
Oh, for sure. People panic.
They picture generalized economic contraction, universal austerity, a loss of technological progress, or a forced return to the Stone Age. It triggers a deep anxiety about scarcity. But within the Life Coherent framework, Saifaly reinterprets the concept entirely. He moves away from the raw term and frames the process as differentiated life coherent convergence.
Differentiated convergence. Okay, so when people hear degrowth, they panic about losing your comfort and security. But reading this breakdown, it sounds much more like an economic diet targeted at a very specific type of unhealthiness.
An economic diet. I like that.
Think about it this way. When you go on a diet to improve your health, you don't just starve your entire body. You don't arbitrarily stop consuming all calories and nutrients. Instead, you specifically cut out the daily donuts, the excess processed sugar, and the trans fats, which in this economic analogy would be things like private jets, planned obsolescence, military expansion, and fast fashion. You cut out the toxic excess so that your body has the energy and resources it needs to build muscle, heal tissue, and function optimally, which corresponds to expanding public transit, building robust healthcare systems, and constructing affordable housing. You actively reduce the destructive excess to fund and fuel the vital necessities. Is that an accurate way to read this concept of differentiated convergence?
That analogy captures the essence of the framework brilliantly. It's about targeted reduction for the purpose of systemic health. This framework completely avoids the false absolute binary of growth versus degrowth that dominates cable news debates.
Right, the endless tug of war.
Instead of asking a blunt question like, should the economy grow or shrink, it asks much more precise, nuanced, and materially grounded questions. What specific sectors of the economy must grow to meet human needs? What specific sectors must shrink to get us back within planetary boundaries? What ecosystems and communities must be repaired? And what resources must be shared more equitably?
The differentiated convergence model outlines three distinct pathways to achieve this.
Okay.
Right? Let's explore how those pathways actually operate, because it's not a one-size-fits-all mandate for the globe. The first pathway is specifically targeted at the high-consuming economies, right?
Yes. The first pathway is the downscaling of destructive excess in high-income, high-consuming economies, predominantly the global north. This means actively and intentionally reducing the material and energy throughput in sectors that do not serve human life capacity and that actively obstruct rapid decarbonization.
What does that look like in practice?
The paper explicitly lists the urgent need to reduce fossil fuel extraction, scale down luxury emissions like mega yachts and private aviation, transition away from individualized private transport systems in favor of mass transit, and significantly reduce militarized production. This is the diet part of your analogy. It's about recognizing that these nations have already vastly exceeded their fair share of the Earth's ecological budget.
But the framework doesn't ask the entire world to go on that diet, which is a crucial distinction. The second pathway focuses on the exact opposite end of the spectrum, the materially deprived societies in the global south.
Exactly. The second pathway is fundamentally an expansion pathway. This is where the term degrowth is entirely inappropriate. While the wealthy north downscales its excess, materially deprived societies in the global south must actually expand their life necessary provisioning.
They need to grow.
Yes. They need more energy generation, more housing construction, more sanitation infrastructure, better healthcare facilities, and more sovereign productive capacity. Their material throughput and energy use actually need to increase significantly to secure a decent living standard for their populations. The framework explicitly supports this necessary growth.
So you have the wealthy nations reducing their massive footprint and the developing nations expanding their footprint to meet basic needs, which naturally leads to the third pathway, the convergence outcome.
The third pathway is the culmination of the first two. converging toward universal sufficiency within planetary boundaries. The high consumers come down from their ecologically destructive heights, the materially deprived come up from the floor of human suffering, and they meet in that sufficiency corridor, that safe and just space we discussed earlier.
The donut.
Exactly. The ultimate goal is enough for all, within the limits of the Earth. Drawing on extensive post-growth research co-authored by Hickel and Aljasa Slemmerak, the text lists 5 core principles that must guide this transition.
What are they?
Prioritizing human well-being, ensuring universal sufficiency, radically reducing inequalities, repurposing the economy away from accumulation, and achieving north-south convergence. It is a highly managed, deeply equitable rebalancing of the global scales, ensuring everyone has enough, but no one has so much that they destroy the planet.
It makes so much sense when you break down the actual mechanics of it. But getting people to accept this requires a massive shift in how we even talk about the economy. How do we break the mental hold of the GDP narrative? The paper addresses this by introducing what it calls the fourfold synthesis.
Yes, this is a fascinating section.
It weaves together McMurtry's life value philosophy, Galtung's structural violence, Hickel's political economy, and then introduces a completely unexpected fourth element from the field of biology, Umberto Maturana and Francisco Varela's concept of autopoiesis and world-bringing.
This is where the paper becomes deeply philosophical, yet provides an incredibly practical tool for change. Maturana and Varela were pioneering Chilean biologists who studied the nature of living systems. Their concept of autopoiesis describes how living systems constantly recreate and maintain themselves.
Like a cell.
Right. A cell is autopoietic. It constantly regenerates its own boundary and internal components. But the paper focuses heavily on their companion concept of world-bringing or languaging. Maturana and Varela argued that human beings do not exist in an objective, pre-existing social reality that we simply observe from the outside.
Okay, so what do we exist in?
Instead, we literally bring forth our world through the distinctions we make, the language we use, and the recurrent practices we engage in together.
So economies aren't like the laws of physics. Gravity exists whether we have a word for it or not, right? It will pull an apple to the ground regardless of our language. But an economy isn't an objective fact of nature. It is a shared social reality that we enact together through the specific words and concepts we use every day.
Beautifully said. The words we use in economics and politics are not merely descriptive labels. They are generative. They create the reality we inhabit. Let's look at a concrete example. When a massive corporation fires 5,000 workers to boost its quarterly stock price, the language we use to describe that event changes how society reacts to it. If the financial press calls it restructuring for efficiency, optimizing human capital, or maintaining competitiveness, society accepts it as a necessary, rational, and even positive action. That language brings forth a world where accumulation is natural and human lives are just inputs.
Wow, yeah.
But if we describe that exact same event using life-coherent language, if we call it systematically depriving 5,000 families of their life means to artificially inflate shareholder dividends, we bring forth a completely different reality. We bring forth a reality that demands an ethical intervention. The text argues that our constant use of terms like scarcity, investment confidence, and growth traps us in the current paradigm.
If we want to change the world, we have to deliberately change the language we use to construct it. We need to shift to terms like life capacity, democratic provisioning, and repair. This is actually incredibly liberating. It means we aren't trapped by some inevitable economic destiny. If we created the rules of the game through our language and our institutions, we have the power to rewrite those rules using a grammar that is answerable to life. And the text extrapolates on how we rewrite those rules practically through the concepts of the civil commons and democratic provisioning.
Democratic provisioning is the tangible institutional application of this new life-coherent language. It means taking the essential means of life, things like clean water, energy generation, healthcare, knowledge, and housing, and governing them as shared conditions of life, rather than treating them as mere commodities to be bought and sold for profit on the open market.
So socializing everything?
Not necessarily. The text is careful to explain that this doesn't mean everything has to be a centralized, state-run monopoly. Provisioning can involve a rich ecosystem of public utility systems, worker cooperatives, commons-based community governance, or hybrid arrangements.
The key test, as the paper lays out, isn't necessarily whether an institution is technically public or private, But whether its core mandate makes it democratically answerable to life need and ecological integrity rather than answerable to shareholder profit.
That's the defining line.
So we have this profound theoretical framework, a new language to describe it, a new way of viewing global trade and unequal exchange. But how do we actually measure this new world? How do we replace the speedometer? This brings us to the architecture of the solution, the seven-domain life coherent dashboard. We started this deep dive by talking about the UN's 31 indicators, but Dr. Sakil proposes a specific, rigorous architecture to assess progress beyond GDP.
The proposed dashboard is a direct translation of the entire life coherent framework into measurable, actionable domains. It is designed to move beyond just tracking superficial outcomes, like simply counting the number of hospitals, and seeks to expose the underlying structural deficits and externalized harms of an economy.
Let's systematically walk through how these seven domains operate together. What is domain one?
Domain one is life necessity sufficiency. This tracks universal access to the foundational material conditions required for a dignified human life. It measures actual access to adequate nutrition, clean water, safe sanitation, secure housing, primary health care, basic education, clean energy, public transport, and social care.
So the absolute basics.
Right. The text anchors this firmly in Ian Goff and Len Doyle's theory of objective human needs, arguing that these aren't just subjective cultural wants, but universal biological and social requirements for human functioning. If a society fails on domain one, nothing else matters.
Okay, so domain one is the baseline material floor. You have to feed and house people first. What does domain two build on top of that?
Domain two is life capacity development. Once the material floor is secured, this domain tracks the higher order capacities of a population. It measures physical and mental health outcomes, continuous learning and skill acquisition, social dignity, political participation, creative expression, personal security, and the structural conditions necessary for meaningful human agency.
So moving from surviving to thriving.
Exactly. It measures whether people aren't just surviving, but actually flourishing and actively belonging to a community.
Well, hold on. Let me push back on this for a second. I get how you measure domain one. You can count calories, you can count housing units, you can measure water quality. But how on earth do you objectively measure dignity or creativity or meaningful agency in domain two without it just becoming a highly subjective, easily manipulated opinion poll that politicians can game?
It is a significant challenge, and the text acknowledges that quantitative metrics have limits. Measuring life capacity development often requires combining objective proxies, like the number of community centers, the time available outside of wage labor, or rates of preventable mental health crises, with rigorous qualitative assessments done by the communities themselves.
Involving the community.
Yes. It requires democratizing the data collection process, allowing communities to define what dignity and agency look like in their specific cultural context, rather than relying solely on top-down technocratic data points.
That makes sense. It requires a different kind of listening. Now, moving on, the main three seems to be the ceiling of the safe and just space we talked about earlier.
Yes. Domain three is life ground integrity. This tracks the strict ecological conditions that sustain all life. It draws heavily on the planetary boundaries framework, specifically citing the work of Johanna Rockström and Catherine Richardson.
Tracking the planetary limits.
Right. It relentlessly monitors carbon emissions, biodiversity loss, land system degradation, freshwater stress, chemical pollution, and coastal health. It is the absolute boundary condition ensuring the economy is operating safely within the biophysical limits of the Earth.
And domain four tackles the internal equity of a society, how things are shared.
Domain four is distribution and inclusion. It recognizes that high aggregate wealth means nothing if it is hoarded. This domain moves beyond national averages to track the fair distribution of life means and opportunities across the entire population.
So inequality metrics.
Yes, it measures the Gini coefficient of income and wealth distribution, but also looks deeper at land access, energy equity, housing security, gender parity, racial equity, and even intergenerational equity.
Okay, domain five gets into the governance aspect we just discussed regarding democratic provisioning, right?
Spot on. Domain five is democratic control of life means. This is a crucial metric of institutional power. It tracks the extent to which essential systems, like the water supply or the energy grid, are governed through public, cooperative, or commons-based accountability structures rather than being subjected to concentrated private monopolistic control.
Making sure the public has a say.
Exactly. It's about measuring actual community participation and democratic stewardship over the resources required for survival.
And domain six is where Hickel's unequal exchange comes in, right? Mm-hmm. This is the relational accountability metric.
This is arguably the most radical and disruptive addition to standard beyond GDP metrics. Domain six is cross-border life drain. It rigorously tracks externalized harms and extractive dependencies.
How so?
Well, it measures embodied labor imports, calculating how much a wealthy nation relies on underpaid labor abroad. It measures the material footprint outsourced to other nations, energy appropriation, historical carbon responsibility, the debt burdens imposed on the periphery by domestic financial institutions, and the overall ecological unequal exchange. It forces a country to confront the true global cost of its domestic lifestyle.
Which leaves the final piece of the puzzle, Domain 7.
Domain 7 is repair and future viability. This domain acknowledges the sobering reality that we have already done massive historical and ecological damage. It tracks active efforts toward climate adaptation, large-scale ecological restoration, the provision of reparative finance to the global south, international debt relief, disaster resilience planning, and the specific institutional safeguards put in place to protect future generations.
So progress is also about fixing the past.
Yes. It frames progress not just as moving forward into the future, but as actively repairing the historical violence and ecological destruction left behind by centuries of extraction. Fanning and Hickel's work on atmospheric appropriation is cited here, framing the excess emissions of the global north as an issue requiring active, measurable, reparative responsibility.
So we have these seven incredible, comprehensive domains. It's a brilliant dashboard that covers everything from housing to global debt to ecological repair. But again, I have to push back on the real-world application of this. Data is great. We love data. But data doesn't plant trees. Data doesn't cancel debt. And data certainly doesn't build affordable housing. A dashboard is just a screen on the wall. How does this intricate seven-domain dashboard actually force change in the real world, especially when powerful interests benefit from the current system?
That is the crucial pivot the paper makes, moving from theory to implementation. The text explicitly warns that dashboards need institutional power. Moving from indicators to institutions is the hardest step in this entire transition.
Right, because otherwise it's just a report.
Exactly. If these seven domains are just used to write a polite, colorful annual report that sits on a shelf at a UN office, nothing changes. The capitalist law of value continues unabated. The paper argues that these domains must be legally and institutionally hardwired into the machinery of government. They must dictate public investment, economic planning, national budgeting, and international trade policies.
So it's about making the dashboard trigger automatic, legally binding actions.
Exactly. The dashboard must direct the engine. For example, if Domain 6 cross-border life drain is flashing red because a country's electric vehicle transition is relying on hyper-exploitative mineral extraction in the global south, the response can't just be a strongly worded report or a corporate pledge to do better.
It has to force a change.
It must automatically trigger a legal shift in trade policy, rigorous supply chain regulations, or mandates to reduce domestic material use and increase recycling. If Domain 1 shows rising food insecurity in a specific region, it must legally trigger immediate interventions in local land policy, state-funded public procurement of food, and emergency social protection programs. The metrics must have teeth.
It's one thing to talk about global trade flows, legal triggers, and theoretical dashboards in the abstract. But what makes this paper so compelling is that Dr. Seidle grounds all of this high-level, dense theory in a very specific, very real-world geography. The paper focuses heavily on small island developing states, or SIDs, and particularly the Caribbean region, which is where the author is originally from.
A very strategic focus.
The text argues that SIDs are the ultimate diagnostic sites for this entire framework.
In small island states, the contradictions of the GDP-centered world are brutally, unavoidably visible. A large, resource-rich continental nation like the United States or Australia might be able to hide its ecological overshoot or externalize its costs across vast distances for a long time, but an island system cannot. The feedback loops are immediate.
It all hits home much faster.
The paper notes that in many Caribbean nations, GDP might steadily go up due to an influx of luxury tourism, offshore banking, or high-end real estate development. But simultaneously, behind that rising GDP number, the nation's sovereign debt exposure deepens. Their dependence on imported processed food grows dangerously high. Their vital coastal ecosystems degrade due to overdevelopment, and they remain hypervulnerable to global fossil fuel price shocks because they import all their energy.
The text paints a vivid picture of a region suffering from what it calls constrained sovereignty. They are entirely surrounded by overwhelming external pressures. The changing climate, international debt markets, unequal trade agreements that severely limit their ability to govern their own life means.
It's a convergence of crises.
The expert details in the text how multiple crises violently converge on these islands. You have the immediate existential threat of Category 5 hurricanes and steady sea level rise, which are driven almost entirely by the historical carbon emissions of the global north. You have severe water stress and prolonged droughts affecting agriculture. And on top of all that, you have straining public health systems dealing with a massive, escalating burden of non-communicable diseases, or NCDs, like diabetes and heart disease.
And those are deeply connected to trade.
Yes. The text points out that these health crises are directly linked to the reliance on imported, highly processed corporate foods, because local, life-sustaining agriculture was historically undermined by colonial plantation economies and modern unequal trade deals.
These island nations are heavily exposed to the whims of global economic shocks and the escalating climate crisis, essentially acting as the canary in the coal mine for the entire planet. They show us exactly what happens when the life ground is degraded, when local provisioning systems are dismantled, and when survival becomes entirely dependent on fragile, unequal, profit-driven global supply chains.
GDP misses all of that.
Conventional economic indicators simply miss the deep structural fragility of these states, painting a false picture of progress right up until the moment a hurricane wipes out 200% of their GDP in a single afternoon.
But what I find incredibly inspiring about this section is that the paper doesn't just treat the Caribbean as a tragic victim of globalization. It frames SIDs as creative diagnostic sites. Because they are forced to confront these harsh realities immediately, because they literally cannot hide the ecological and social costs, SIDs are actually the perfect places to prototype and pioneer life-coherent transitions for the rest of the world to learn from.
The text suggests that the life-coherent agenda for SIDs isn't just theoretical. It involves very tangible, integrated, life-saving solutions. It means developing robust regional food systems through sustainable agroecology to break the dangerous dependence on food imports. It means securing local water and wastewater management systems.
They're taking back their sovereignty.
It means achieving complete renewable energy sovereignty utilizing solar, wind, and geothermal to permanently escape the crushing volatility of imported fossil fuels. And crucially, it means demanding systemic debt justice and massive climate adaptation finance on the global stage, holding the core nations accountable for cross-border life drain. SIDs reveal to the world that genuine progress cannot be measured by a rising GDP alone, but by the tangible resilience of community provisioning systems and the recovery of meaningful democratic sovereignty.
So what does this all mean? We have covered an immense amount of ground today, navigating through some incredibly dense and paradigm-shifting concepts. We started by looking at the UN's push to move beyond GDP, and we realized that a broken measurement compass is just a symptom of a deeper disease. An economic engine fundamentally designed for the endless accumulation of money rather than the well-being of humanity.
A machine that serves itself.
We explored the terrifying reality of the double crisis, where we systematically misallocate our massive global productive capacity toward destructive excess-like fast fashion and private jets, while actively ignoring the universal life necessities of billions of people. We saw how this conscious misallocation isn't just an error, but a form of structural violence, which is constantly normalized by the cultural narratives we tell ourselves about efficiency and the market.
We then expanded our lens globally, examining the stark realities of unequal exchange and how the prosperity of the global north is built on a continuous cross-border life drain from the global south. We tackled the highly controversial concept of degrowth, redefining it as a carefully managed, differentiated convergence where wealthy nations downscale their toxic excess, deprived nations expand their vital necessities, and we all meet in a safe, just, sufficiency corridor.
We recognize the profound power of our own language, drawing on biology to understand how we actually bring forth the economic world we live in through the words we use. We explored how a rigorous seven-domain dashboard could provide a new, life-coherent metric for progress, provided we have the courage to attach those metrics to real, binding institutional power.
Giving the dashboard teeth.
And finally, we looked at the Caribbean and other small island developing states as the ultimate proving ground, the canary in the coal mine showing us both the devastating fatal flaws of the current capitalist law of value and the urgent necessity of prototyping a resilient, life-coherent alternative.
The ultimate thesis of Dr. Cifelli's paper is profound in its moral clarity. It states unequivocally that an economy is only legitimate insofar as it serves human life capacity, protects the ecological life ground, actively repairs historical and environmental damage, and remains democratically answerable to those whose lives are affected by it. Life is not an externality of the economy. Life is the ground, the necessary condition, and the ultimate measure of all legitimate economic activity.
I want to leave you, the listener, with a challenge based on this deep dive. The next time you are listening to the morning news or reading a financial report and you hear politicians or pundits cheering about record GDP growth or an expanding economy, I want you to pause for a second. Ask yourself the life-coherent question. Is this specific economic growth actually enabling human life capacities? Is it building houses, healing the sick, educating children, or is it just accumulating money while draining the life ground and exploiting labor somewhere else in the world?
It fundamentally changes how you process every piece of economic news. You stop cheering for the speedometer and you start looking for the structural violence hiding behind sanitized efficiency statistics.
And I want to end by circling back to that incredible concept of world bringing from Maturana and Varela. We literally construct our shared reality through the language we use every single day. So here's a final lingering thought for you to mull over as you go about your week. If the words we use literally bring forth the world we live in, well, what is one word or phrase that you use constantly in your own job, in your own community, in your own life that is secretly prioritizing throughput, accumulation, and efficiency over actual life? What is that word? And more importantly, what word will you deliberately replace it with tomorrow? Because if we truly want an economy that is answerable to life, we have to start speaking it into existence. Thank you so much for joining us on this incredibly expansive, challenging journey today. We will see you on the next deep dive.